So, Bob, we are in a weird situation in that for the first time in a long time, I have recorded a bunch of audio episodes, so much so that I have enough episodes for a few weeks. And I don't like to get too far ahead because it feels weird to record an episode and then publish it like 2 months later. So normally you and I would record two episodes today and then publish those over the next couple of weeks. But I have yet to publish, as of today, episodes that we've recorded over the past month. And so I think it would be a bad idea to record two episodes. So what I thought we'd do is record one really long episode.
All right.
But we would make the first half hour free. But this episode would probably be a few hours. We will actually try to answer every question that people have submitted that are relevant to our conversations. What do you say, Bob?
Ambitious. Like it.
Yeah. Anonymous patron, they said, I was listening to your podcast and you mentioned how you hate therapists writing notes in a particular style. You know, I'll often rant about how I'll read therapist notes and it'll be something like, it'll have all these abbreviations in it that I don't even necessarily know what they mean. It will have this super weird cadence and syntax, like, you know, DBT skill number 5 set to high level, or I don't know, something like that, where I'm like, I don't understand what that means, you know? And I'm not even really describing it well. Mm-hmm. Just incomplete sentences. That, because if it's a complete sentence, if I say, I talked with a client today about their relationship, that's an easy sentence to understand by anyone, right? But a lot of times they'll write something like, client talked to therapist, RE, relationship or something like that. And when I see those sentences in my supervisee's notes, it takes me, I have to read it two or three times to remind myself, oh, they're referring to themselves. Client talked to therapist. Therapist is the author of this note. It's not, because you could conceivably write a note that says, my client talked with their other therapist about their relationship. That could, how do you differentiate between that sentence and client talked to therapist, meaning you, client talked to me? And I'm always, you're the one signing the fucking progress note. Just say client talked with me, or I talked with the client. Use I and me. Why is that a bad word in a clinical note? But they avoid those pronouns, I and me. It's never in this style of note. I'm always just like, it's confusing and unclear.
Medical world.
But I don't even know if medical people necessarily, anyway.
Oh, yes, they do.
Okay, well, yeah. And I've always contended that it's born out of insecurity, that these people are insecure and they're terribly insecure about their practice and their progress notes include, you know, because there's a lot of insecurity about progress notes, because it's when you have to kind of commit to your work and describe it, and trainees aren't trained enough in that area. They're not supervised enough. They're not helped enough. Some are, but most aren't. And so they resort to this convoluted way because in their head, they're just like, well, if it looks technical, maybe people will think I'm competent. And that's, I don't know if that's true, but it always kind of seemed that way to me.
The medical world will write in this third person way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know about the medical world. Maybe they have reasons for that, but I've always taught my trainees to write in full sentences that make sense. Because the other thing that I will say is that not only is it weird for me as a supervisor, if I can't understand your notes, you have failed as a supervisee. If I don't understand what you're saying, you have failed, because in order for me to supervise you, I have to know what you're doing in a session to some extent. And if in order for me to do that, I have to understand what's in your notes, because that's the only record of what you did. The other thing is it's clearly in our ethical codes that your notes should be understood by your client, and you can't guarantee your client has a high level of education. So the guideline is either 8th grade or 10th grade education. So your notes should be in that readable area, meaning that it should be extremely clear and devoid of any kind of lingo or jargon or abbreviations. It's in the training. It's in the ethics. If you have a progress note that your client can't understand, then why is there a progress note? That's not, you know, because the file is there for a variety of people. It's not just there for you. It's there for you. It's there for your supervisor. It's there for auditors. It's there for other clinicians that don't even work in the psychotherapy field. It's also there for your client. So that's what the progress note, the treatment plan, it's all there for all those people. It's not just there for you. Anyway, so I was ranting about that, and I just ranted about it again. You said that you think this has to do with clinicians being insecure. However, for myself, so going back to anonymity, you said that you think this has to do with clinicians being insecure. However, for myself, I was literally taught to write and document notes this way as an intern. Just chiming in here. Yeah, that's the problem. People are taught to write in this stupid way, which I'm like, why? Justify that, please. Please, people out there, if you teach or you do this and you feel like it's the right way, email in. Give me a justification. I'm willing to change my mind. I'm guessing there isn't a good justification. I'm just going to say that. They go on, I hate writing notes this way, but I'm not sure how else to write my progress notes. Every other clinical note I've seen has been written this way. Help. How should a progress note look? Well, so to answer that question, it depends on what you mean, because I haven't seen what you're referring to as annoying notes. But every instruction manual on treatment plans and on progress note writing will teach you the way I'm talking about it, which is very clear. It's supposed to be things like, you know, the client talks about their relationship this session, and then you have maybe a client quote, right? Some notes you're required to put in a little quote, like, quote, I am very sad about my relationship this week or so. And then you would write, we discussed ways the client could manage the conflict, and the client said they would give it a try this week and let me know. So you have all the soap note format kind of a thing. There's no jargon in there. There's no abbreviations in there. It's all understood. An eighth grader could basically understand what that means. Now, sometimes there has to be some clinical stuff. You know, if you are doing a DBT module, for example, you might have like DBT module number 5 completed today or something like that. So it's not wrong to have that. But anyway. Up at your patron Alex from Vancouver Island, she says, The psychologist I've been working with has offered to do sessions for free. Is that normal? I feel bad and greedy when I have taken free sessions before. My coverage through work only covers 2 appointments annually, but he said he's willing to work with me for free. So just think about that her coverage, you know, you always think Canada, everything's always better up there, right? But apparently there are some people in Canada, or at least one person, that only gets 2 appointments a year. I mean, that's pretty awful. So yeah, but then he says he's willing to work with me for free, aside from those 2 appointments a year. I took 5 sessions for free that year because I really needed it. My coverage has restarted for the year, so I made an appointment with him, and he told me again, if my coverage is used up or I can't afford it, he's willing to not charge me for sessions. Is it okay for me to accept free sessions from him? Should I feel weird about it or guilty? In my past, I feel like there have always been obligations attached to kind gestures, gifts, or handouts. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's something to talk to the therapist about. It's churning something up for you about whether safety and trust and all that's worthy of therapy. Could be that the therapist is really committed to you and has within their, you know, limit to see some clients pro bono and, you know, picked you as one of those folks. So I think rather than trying to figure it out, I think it's reasonable for you to talk with the therapist about it, and then also decide for yourself if this is an okay deal for you, because just because it's offered doesn't mean you have to accept it. You don't have to. And if it's too weird for you, if it makes it feel like too guilty or too much pressure or whatever, or you're wondering, you know, too anxious, then, you know, you can turn it down. But let's not presume that because it's offered, there's something wrong or nefarious about it, or, you know, they might just be really generous.
Right, exactly. There's nothing creepy about it. It's not some sort of indication of a boundary violation. Yeah. It's standard practice. Yeah. Pro bono is what we call it, and it's actually ethical to provide this. Not necessarily at all times, but ethical codes will call on clinicians to actually help people who are in need. And one of the ways you can do that is to provide pro bono services. So yeah, totally normal. I've done it before. I've provided free services to people, sometimes midstream therapy. Their insurance will run out and I'll just say, well, I'm willing to work with you for free because I care about you and I don't want you to, you know, terminate therapy in the middle of it. So I would take them up on it. The other thing I would say is that the problem is that you are unfairly being treated by the government or your insurance company or something. So your therapist is trying to make up for that in an altruistic, selfless way. And you should capitalize on that because you deserve it. Upper tier patron Lana from Rhode Island. You been to Rhode Island before?
No, I don't think. Oh, probably. No, I have not.
You lived out there.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if there's any reason to go to Rhode Island. Isn't there a part of Rhode Island that's not an island? Isn't it like...
I don't think any of it's an island, is
oh,
it?
Oh, none of it's an island.
Oh, I'll have to look it up.
It's just like a part of... It's like, what is it, next to Massachusetts or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, it's up there in New England, next to Massachusetts, yeah. Connecticut.
What a weird state, if you think about
Vermont,
it.
Vermont, maybe.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Neither Rhode nor an island.
She says, I was recently hired as an outpatient therapist at a group practice that provides intensive eating disorder services. Mm-hmm. They asked me to sign a non-compete agreement to not treat eating disorders for 2 years after termination from the group practice. Thoughts on contractual restrictions for treating certain mental disorders? Bob, what do you think?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it as far as I know. It's perfectly legit. You get to decide for yourself whether or not you want to enter into a contract with them. Maybe you negotiate it. Probably not, though. Probably, you know, they're sort of holding the cards and, you know, you want to work here. This is our deal. I never liked them, non-compete clause. I got offered a job that had that in it, and I was already in private practice. There's no way. I was like, I'm not giving up what I'm doing just because you guys want me to. You just really what you're doing is just trying to protect your own bottom line. Which is totally legit, just not a game I want to play. So I said, no, I don't want to work here. I don't want to do more work for less money, doing something that you would just absorb so that you could, what, have another clinician on your staff and I get to be, what, your employee? Nah, just so stay doing my own thing the way I'm doing it. Thanks for the offer, you know. No, thank you.
Yeah.
But this the thing that turned me off was the non-compete clause. It said, for 1 year, within a certain geographic radius of Seattle, you're not allowed to do this kind of work. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that. Right. Fuck, I got here before you guys did.
Right.
I ain't doing it.
Right.
So I don't think there's anything illegitimate about it. But, you know, it could hamstring you. If you learn all you want to learn at that place or you feel like you outgrow it or whatever, then you're setting yourself up for a bit of hardship if that's the kind of work you want to do not working there. So, you know, it's legit. You can do it. And, you know, there's pros and cons.
Yeah. When were you applying for a group practice?
I didn't apply.
Oh, but when were you looking?
I wasn't looking. I just got offered.
Oh.
Yeah. The DBT Center downtown asked me if I wanted to work for them. I was already running my skills class, plus I was working at the Linehan Clinic, and they're like, well, you know, you want to come work for us? And I said, oh, thank you. That's a lovely offer now.
Yeah. If the non-compete wasn't there, would you have taken it? Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
Right. I mean,
I like that place. There's a good clinic. I think the therapists that work there, they're fantastic. Got no complaints about them. Refer to them all the time.
Yeah.
Just didn't want to hamstring myself that way.
Right. Group practices are primarily for novice therapists who are unable at that stage to get their own full practice on their own anyway, because the trade-off is pretty high. Usually the group practice will take half or more of the fee.
Yeah.
So instead of getting $100 an hour, you're getting $50 an hour. And for novice therapists, it works out because it's a win-win, because the novice therapist doesn't have a client load yet and has maybe an inability to get clients, particularly if they're an associate licensed individual.
Right.
So it's a win-win for the novice therapist.
Yeah.
They get paid a lot more than they would at an agency, and they're in private practice in a group practice. And the agency gets to skim off the top because they have too many, you know, whoever built the practice, usually they have too many clients coming. And so they start a group practice.
Yeah.
And usually the novice therapist, once they get to a certain level, they break off on their own. And that, you know, so yeah, I don't like non-compete either. It's greedy. It's anti-client because for the, you know, the therapist in the group practice, if they ever did decide to leave, they're usually leaving midstream with 20 clients on their caseload. And when you find a good therapist, it's hard, and a good fit, it's hard. And also transitioning between therapists midstream treatment is a hardship. It sometimes doesn't result in good things. It could result in some good things, but it's a risk. And so I find it on the behalf of the organization to be solely based on greed and money, mm-hmm. and also is counter to the ethical codes around client treatment integrity. You know, I don't know the legality of it. I can tell you I've never seen it enacted upon.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of group practicing therapists that will terminate and violate, so to speak, the non-compete clause, and I've never seen someone get sued for it. Because I don't know, but I think it would be really hard to sue someone. So this is what I would say is that I would tell my supervisees, because they would ask me, so this group practice, you know, they want me to do this, and I would say something similar to you, which is, well, you might want to consider not working for them, or telling them I would work for you if it weren't for this stupid non-compete clause. I mean, I get it, because on one hand, they're like, well, one, especially if they train the individual, you know, they're spending a lot of it, they're investing in the therapist. Also, if they work really hard to market, they spend a lot of money to market the group practice and to get the clients in, and then someone comes to work for them, a therapist, and absorbs 30 clients solely because of the group practice's marketing budget and expertise and savvy. And then that therapist after a year just leaves and takes all 30 of your clients that you built for that person. That doesn't seem fair, right? And I get that for sure. But to me, I'm like, that's just kind of the risk you take when you're doing that kind of thing, you know? You could suggest to the therapist that they shouldn't do that. It's uncool, because it is kind of uncool, particularly if you, as a therapist, were like, you have to come with me. You know what I mean? Like,
you can't do that.
Yeah. But if you give them a choice, it's like you can either transfer to another therapist within the group practice, or you can follow me into my private practice, you know, and it's truly a choice that the client has that they won't feel bad about either way, which would be hard to engineer, honestly. But anyway,
I'm not even sure you could do that. Are you? I think what you have to say is, I'm leaving, I'm setting up a practice somewhere else. You have the right to choose any provider you want. And, you know, it's entirely up to you, and I support whatever you do. You can certainly stay here. They will help you find another therapist.
Yeah.
You can establish, and that, you know, that's great. And, you know, you just have to, whatever to do for you, that's the best, is really the only thing that we have to consider.
Right.
I don't think you're allowed to poach. I don't know about the allowed part. I'm sure you're allowed to do all kinds of things. But in terms of, you know, just what's decent, poaching is probably not the best.
Well, it depends, because if I had a supervisee that had, say, five really core clients that they really bonded with, and they were in the middle of trauma treatment, and I would support the supervisee in making a statement to those clients that it's recommended by me and my supervisor that you actually follow me into private practice. You don't have to. You can absolutely go with someone else, but we're in the middle of your treatment, and it would maybe set you back a bit if you transfer.
Right.
So that's my recommendation, but again, you're free
to do.
So if they said something like that, I would absolutely support that, because I think that would be in the client's best interest, not in the therapist, but in the client's best interest.
Right.
So what I would tell supervisees is, I would say, well, one, you might not want to work there, and I would give pushback, because I think some of these non-competes would be pretty severe, like this one that they're saying, 2 years after you leave, you can't even treat anyone with eating disorders.
Probably in a geographic
in the area, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. So I would say, but if you take the job and the time comes when you leave, I say screw them. Screw the practice. One, because how would the group practice know that you took clients? Because they would have to contact the clients individually and say, did you follow this person? All they know is the client terminated from the group practice, you know? And I just can't imagine a group practice doing that. Two, even if they did find that one or more clients did follow you into your private practice, or you hung a shingle nearby a month later and said you were treating eating disorders, what's the group practice going to do? They're going to sue you? They're going to take you to court? Like, I just can't see that happening.
It's a lot of rigmarole.
Yeah. It's expensive. Yeah. I don't think you would win. I mean, I don't know the legality of it.
Either, yeah.
Also, clients could countersue and say, so you are preventing me from working with my therapist that I've bonded with, that I'm getting better. And with, you know, these three clients, it's a matter of life and death because they have suicidal thoughts. Like, really, group practice, because you're greedy? Like, you want to enter? I just can't imagine that happening.
You get that real sticky.
Yeah. So that's what I would always say. I would always just be like, screw group practices for doing that. And I will tell you that the group practices that I recommend, like Modern Therapy Seattle, a friend of mine owns that in Seattle, and she doesn't have a non-compete clause. In fact, she even encourages the leaving therapist to take whatever clients they want, because she's not greedy, and she has compassion for not only clients, but also for the burgeoning therapists, because most of her group practicing employees are fresh grads, and then they leave after 2 or 3 years, and it's just a part of her, she just works it into her business plan.
Is her business model sort of around training young therapists?
I don't know if there's a lot of training. I don't know if there's a lot of shepherding. I think a lot of the group practicing therapists are kind of on their own to some extent.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah.
Interesting.
So let's take a break, Bob, and we get back more emails.
Yep.
All right, we're back from the break. Anonymous upper tier patron from Canada, she says, is it normal for a therapist to push psychiatrist services despite me telling them that I have a family doctor who offers me the same service? I just started therapy for postpartum rage. I confided to my therapist that I did yell at my baby and occasionally struggled with controlling my anger. There is a specific trigger that sets me off, so knowing that, most of the time, I can get my husband to help before my anger gets worse. I mentioned to my therapist that my family doctor prescribed some antidepressants. My therapist was actively pushing for me to schedule a consultation with the psychiatrist that they work with. I shared that I am paying for therapy out of pocket, and since the psychiatrist is a private doctor, I would have to pay for him out of pocket too. The state covers my family doctor services. I'm in Canada. The therapist replied she would drop her fee for the subsequent 6 sessions to accommodate the psychiatrist's expense. The way my therapist pushed for me to work with their affiliated psychiatrist undermined my trust for some reason and made me feel uneasy. Are my feelings of distrust justified? Bob, what do you think?
Well, I don't know if they're justified, but it sounds like an offer meant to accommodate what they believe is your need. Oh. So you should talk about this. You should definitely talk about this with the therapist. I hope you do, whether you take them up or not. What you've written here makes me think, though, that they're just thinking about your well-being and your welfare, that's their chief concern. And that, you know, there's nothing wrong with your primary doc prescribing, and you might avail yourself the opinion of somebody who does that all day long, just to sort of get a second opinion. Why not, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I guess, my thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to piggyback on that, you're absolutely free, anonymous upper tier patron, to decline their offer. You can say, no, I'm good. I like my family doctor and their prescription services. But it's not a indication of a lack of trustworthiness. It's actually the opposite. your therapist in all likelihood comes from a place that when one is suffering from issues such as yourself, it's important to get really strong expertise regarding medication management and prescription and the side effects, the downsides. And so, you know, experts, psychiatrists, are more likely to know more about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas your family doctor has to know about all sorts of things and probably doesn't know that much about antidepressants. Now, some family doctors know a shit ton about antidepressants because they have specific training or experience or personal experience or something. So some family doctors know more than the average psychiatrist. But on average, that's definitely not the case. I mean, family doctors have to know everything, every medical issue they have to have some knowledge about.
That is a hard job.
Yeah, and psychiatry is extremely complicated. And imagine, you know, if you have cancer, you're not going to go to your family doctor, you're going to go to a cancer specialist. Well, if you have a psychiatric need, such as antidepressants being prescribed, you would probably be better off going to someone that literally that's all they do all day long is talk about psychotropics. So your therapist is advocating for you. Now, again, you don't have to do it.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be unusual for a client to say, yeah, nah, I'm good with my family doctor. But the fact that your therapist is willing to, because you said, I can't afford it. You're like, I can't afford it. But I can't afford my family doctor. I can't afford to go to a psychiatrist. And the fact that your therapist says, I will give you 6 sessions for free, which is essentially your therapist saying, I'm going to give you the money, because that's what the therapist is doing. That's a lot of money. 6 sessions, that's a lot of money that the therapist is losing. And your therapist is saying, I will pay for you out of my own pocket, my own personal checking account. I will pay for you to go to this psychiatrist. You don't have to do it. Like I said, you can decline it. But I would say that that means your therapist is very trustworthy and very altruistic and very oriented towards social justice. I don't know a single therapist. Would you do that if you were really trying to help a client to go? Would you forego? Really?
I might. It depends.
I don't know many other therapists that would, honestly, because I've heard this. I've heard this kind of conflict before issue before, where a therapist is, you know, trying to advocate and the client's just like, well, I can't really afford it. And then the therapist is like, well, okay, I don't know what to do. I can't think of any therapist that would just essentially say, I will pay for it personally.
Right.
Because that's what the therapist is doing.
That's what they're doing.
I think that indicates a good thing.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that we've had two emails now from people that have therapists that are offering them free services, and the clients will worry that it somehow indicates a nefarious issue, you know? And I don't know where that comes from. Like, someone's offering you something for free. Now, the previous emailer said, I have a history of gifts having things tied to it, that someone would offer me something and then they would hold it over my head. So I get that trauma, but maybe this could be a corrective experience for y'all of just like accepting a gift from someone. Again, you don't have to go to the psychiatrist. That's your own choice. But honestly, if I were in your shoes, anonymous upper tier patron, I would take them up on it, because if I can consult with an expert for free, you don't have to give up your family doctor. You don't even have to follow what the second psychiatrist says, but you can get an expert consultation for free.
Sure.
Like, I don't know. I think that would some it'd be it's and it's some it's hard to get a consultation with a psychiatrist. So, you know, you don't have to take their advice, but I would avail yourself of that. That's just what I would do.
What do you think? Do you think maybe it's generosity that's suspect? Mm. You know, like maybe we're not used to kindness and generosity. You know, you ever seen that movie Willy Wonka? Mm-hmm. You know, the old one, Gene Wilder?
Yeah.
There's a line in there where Charlie Bucket, he gives Willy Wonka back his everlasting gobstopper. And you see him put his hand over the candy, and he says, so goes a good deed in a weary world. I mean, we're just not used to it. I love generosity. It's one of my favorite things. Kindness is gold. It's rare. Maybe these folks are tapped into something that happens to us. We don't act that way to one another. We're so insular or something. I don't know. Maybe it's just weird.
Yeah.
Everybody's insular and self-involved and self-seeking, and that's not bad by itself, but we're not used to looking after one another in that way.
Yeah, it makes me sad.
Yeah, me too. But I like it, you know? These therapists, they're like offering something.
Yeah.
You know, for all we know, they're doing it for themselves because they want to feel good at night or be able to sleep or know they made a contribution that's substantial or get right with God or who knows what. But, you know, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it makes me think, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to think this, is that our materialistic capitalistic culture is based on transaction and merit of transaction.
Yeah.
And if there's an imbalance in a transaction, it's suspect.
Yeah.
There's something wrong there. You're not following the rules.
Right.
You can't just give me something for free. Right. There must be something that you want.
Yeah.
And how sad is that, that we live in a society that generosity is suspect.
Yeah.
That just giving for giving's sake is considered dangerous.
Can't tell the difference between that and somebody who actually might want something for free, you know, or want something in exchange.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't tell the difference.
Yeah. You're on the hook, you know.
Yeah.
You owe them.
I like to make anonymous donations.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody to know I'm giving them nothing.
Yeah.
I just assume them have the benefit of the thing with whatever and to think about me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Up at your patron, Morgan from Edmonton, Alberta. We're getting a lot of Canada emails. She says, what do you do for self-care? You have mentioned in the past that you take on multiple roles at once. For example, while completing your doctorate a while back, you were working full-time as a professor, you were podcasting, you were working as a therapist, you were being a supervisor and having a social life. Did you ever get overwhelmed with the amount you signed up for? Do you have any self-care activities that you do to help you stay on track? I also find that I get involved with a lot of different things at once. And was wondering how you typically balance these expectations along with taking care of yourself and completing daily life tasks. Well, Bob, what do you do for self-care?
Let's see. What do I do for self-care? I have a beer with Colleen in the backyard. I pet my dog. I read, I write, I get involved in various little projects around the house. Recently rehabbed a really old tool chest, you know, from like the 60s or the 70s. And I thought, oh yeah, we'll keep it out of the landfill, right? And yeah, I traded keeping that thing out of the landfill for, you know, 25 cans of spray paint. If I could do it over again, I probably would have skipped it. But it was a project that took me weeks and weeks. There's this drawing thing I've been working on. I showed to you three versions of that I'd done so far. And, you know, I do stuff like that. Lately it's clean out my garage. That's my current project.
Mm-hmm.
And, so anyways, I like doing projects, that kind of thing. That's my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Spending time with friends, you know, going out, get a bite to eat somewhere, sleep, like me a good nap, watch golf on Thursdays and Fridays during my lunch hour.
You do?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know you watched golf.
On Thursdays and Fridays during my lunch hour. And then
how many hours of golf do you watch?
Oh, just an hour. I got it just between clients, you know, lunch hour.
Do you record golf?
No. That televises golf events on Thursdays and Fridays.
Oh.
Yeah.
Live?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
On the Golf Channel.
On the Golf Channel.
Yeah. And I'll watch football this fall with, you know, my usual mixed feeling of like, am I supporting, you know, this sort of barbaric event, these young men getting concussions and stuff. Like, but I'll watch it anyways, just with, you know, moral angst. That's my stuff.
Yeah, I have identical self-care practices, so I'll just say
I know,
ditto.
I see you in my garage a lot.
The thing, though, that I think is important to highlight, because I always dislike the discourse around "quote unquote" self care in our industry. It's often brought up as like, make sure you self care, and I always find like, well, are you going to really help the individuals? Because just saying that isn't necessarily going to help. And then the second layer also kind of irks me a little bit, that people will say, okay, what's one thing you're going to do for self-care this week? And it's not a bad conversation. It's not hurtful, but I find it never really hits the mark. Because for me, it's not like I make a plan for self-care. It sounds odd to me, and I think I finally figured out today why it's odd to me, which is that it never comes to my head, I need to self-care. There have been a few moments where I'm like, oh, I'm burning out. Like when I was doing the trial, the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp trial, there was a point there where I was like, oh, I think I'm burning out. And I guess you could say did some self-care things like venting or crying or taking a break or slowing down or reorganizing my life or doing something fun, taking a break, you know, that kind of stuff. And you mentioned up to your patron Morgan during my doctorate. Yeah. I mean, I was even doing some more things. I was in a band at the time, pretty active band. We were playing probably once or twice a week at the time. So,
hey, I saw you twice over that 4-year period.
Probably.
So, you know, there was that too.
Yeah. Where did we play? Where did you see us?
No, I didn't see your band. I saw you.
Oh, you saw me. Yeah, I hardly ever socialized.
No, you did not.
I didn't watch any football.
That's right. You gave up football. Yeah.
I didn't watch any sports.
Yeah.
I didn't watch TV. There's a whole series, you know, from 2010 to 2014. All the news that was happening at that time, I don't really have any knowledge of, because I consciously, like, people would say, hey, let's watch a football game. I'd be like, I can't. But I would say, if you want to hang out for half an hour and actually have really quality face-to-face conversation time, then let's do that. But I can't waste 5 hours watching a game because there's too little social gain to the amount of time spent.
Right.
But anyway, so, I mean, during my doctorate, so it's not only full time, I was actually more than full time classes, but I was also working on my dissertation, which is a whole other thing, which is almost like a full time job. I was also learning how to reaccreditate get reaccreditation for our program, which is also another kind of full time job.
Oh, man.
I was also at multiple internships. So I had my practice and I was at in my final internship, it was a full-time job. So midway, I did start to burn out. And what I noticed was that my brain was literally, I would see static.
Ew.
Like the way a TV looks with static. I could feel and hear and see static. And I thought, I'm pushing too hard, you know?
Yeah.
But the realization I made was that to truly engage in self-care, you have to be in touch with your feelings and your needs and spontaneously react. Because if you wait until Friday, because that's often the way self-care is talked about.
Right.
It's like, oh, I go on hikes on the weekend or something.
Right.
And I'm like, well, what do you do on Monday when you need self-care? Like you need constant, especially therapists, particularly novice therapists, graduate students, you need daily. And that's always what I will tell first quarter students is it's time for you to call in all of your social favors, because I'm guessing you are the listener in your relationships. You're the supporter. It's time for that to reverse. You're going to tell your spouse, I know I'm always here for you. You have to now always be there for me. And maybe it's temporarily more intense, but you got to call in all your favors. And the way that looks is that you need to talk with someone for at least a half an hour every day, every night. You need to download what you did that day, what you went through, because you're going to go through so many things every day and you're going to have a lot of self-esteem issues, ups and downs. You have to have someone that you can talk to every day. And like half the class, they look at me like every day, because, you know, half the class, they live alone or they've never had someone that they could talk to. And they're like, really? I need that. I'm like, yeah, if you don't have that, you're going to fall apart, because you will. Because graduate school is, in therapy, is one of the most stressful psychological, emotional life experiences you'll ever have. It can be glorious, but it's rough. I mean, right? Was it rough for you?
I don't remember graduate school being rough. There was some stressful shit around my internship. I really liked grad school.
I liked it too.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was rough. It's stressful.
Yeah.
It's a lot of intensity.
A lot of intensity. The intensity of ours wasn't so much the academic part of it, though. I don't think it was the personal part of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the unexpected part. Because people are like, well, I'm a good student. I can make this happen. I'm like, well, that'll be part of the stress. But most of it will just be the emotional side.
Right.
In various different ways. But anyway, so for me, when I think about my ongoing self-care practices, I immediately know what I feel and have had 51 years to develop like an impulse to satisfy quote unquote my self-care needs, you know? So for example, if, you know, when I think back over the past couple of weeks, I can think back to a couple of days where I just spontaneously, you know, Stacy and I around 3 or 4 will start thinking about dinner. And we're like, what do we do? Do we make dinner? Do we go out? Do we order, you know, order in?
Yeah.
Do we meet up with people, or, you know, what do we do? And she was like throwing out something more kind of routine. And I was like, let's go to a movie and go to one of those, you know, theaters that has food and drinks and stuff, you know what I mean? And
did you do it?
Yeah. And so I'm guessing in that moment, like, I needed to unwind.
Yeah.
I couldn't, because if I stay home, I'll probably work more, or it'll just be like a little
thing. That's the thing about working from home.
Yeah. I need to just get away.
Yeah.
And, you know, but there was no moment where I'm like, I need self-care. Go to self-care list. You know, it was a almost mostly unconscious, like, impulse of like, I need this. I need a break.
Right.
I need to unwind. And my body knew how to get there. And so I think that's the ideal. And if you don't have that, then obviously you have to kind of concretize your practices. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Concretize them if you need to.
Yeah.
But you're also talking about living in a balanced way, you know, like in general.
Right. That you don't wait till Sunday.
Right.
Or wait until it bursts at the seams.
Right.
Like, you're in a constant state of notice, you know, because again, the word self-care, it just, I don't know why it's always kind of irked me. A better phrase is know your needs.
Yeah.
Like, you need to, as a therapist, practice what you preach and be in a constant state of knowing your needs.
Yeah. Learning them. Right. You never know what your limits are until you cross them, but that's good. That's how you learn. So, but yeah, self-care, it sounds like, I don't know, a little froofy, little fluffy, little like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, some self-care. Yeah. Then sound real.
Yeah. It sounds like, I don't know. It sounds like something that you would prescribe, or that you'd have a workbook around, you know, and really the core is know your needs.
Dr. Kirk Honda's big book of self-care.
Just 3 words, know your needs. comma, motherfucker.
That's a small book. That's Dr. Honda's small book of self-care.
Did you notice that 2 planes flew overhead, which annoyed me because of the sound, but 2, they both obscured the sun. Did you notice that?
I heard the planes. I didn't notice.
Well, you couldn't see because I can see because...
Oh, because I'm where I'm angled.
Yeah. So these are 2 small planes that eclipse the sun, like, because the shadow obscured the sun for, you know, a blip behind your head.
They're flying pretty close if that's going to happen.
Well, I don't know how close, but how random it is
random.
That 2 planes would go right in the path of the sun, in between the sun and my house.
Right.
I don't know. I just thought that was kind of... Because when the first plane did it, I thought that was kind of weird, because that was just like a minute ago. And then 30 seconds ago, another plane did it, and I'm like...
Damn.
Yeah, I don't know. I like coincidences. Like, all right.
You need some self-care.
Yeah. So, Bob, let's stop the free section there.
Whoa.
But the rest of it's going to be patron only.
Oh, you got to pay.
We're only like a fourth of the way down the page. So we probably have like another 16 hours. So if you want to listen to the rest of this, you got to become a patron, and we'll answer more patron emails, and do it now.